record, in attendance today, Representative Lynn, Representative Herron, Representative Ramris, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Grunberg has an excused absence, and Representative Gatto, is he here?
Yes.
He is lunching with the famous silver medalist Carrie Wyland, who is the best of America. She's such an amazing, poised young lady. We should make about 30 million of her. She's amazing. So today's piece of business, we're delighted to have Sue McLean with us again. And I think today's work is going to focus primarily on 324 for the balance of the day. That's going to be our scope of work for the day, so that we can conclude the three bills that the governor has identified as being important and critical to what we're doing. And I would appreciate from the Department of Law, because of other discussions that the House Majority Caucus is having, is if Jane or Sue through the Department of Law could do a compilation of all the fiscal notes that are generated from all three of the pieces of legislation, 298, the DNA bill, which I think had a zero fiscal note, and any of the fiscal notes that are attached to 324, and figure out how to do a compilation of those for us for the discussion that we're having about sexual assault and domestic violence in our House caucus. I think that it would be beneficial for this membership and for the broader discussion going on in there. We have folks that are in the room available for us, and then we also have online to answer questions. Rachel Levitt from Office of Public Advocacy, and Jeffrey Mittman from the ACLU, and my favorite, Lieutenant Rodney Dial, is available also with the Department of Public Safety by telephone. We do have a new CS for House Bill 324 before us, and it is the R as in Roger version. Before us, 26-GH2910/R-Luckup. And Sue, if you would come join us. I don't think we need to move this CS, right? It's just a new... We do have to adopt it, yeah. So I will take the chair will accept the motion.
Mr. Chair, I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 324, version R, as in Roger.
Seeing no objection, then we have the CS for House Bill 324, version Roger, in front of us. And no, we can have this prepared for caucus. When are we meeting as a caucus next?
Wednesday. Tuesday at 5.
Tuesday, next week. So if we could have that... and I'd like to, I think I'd like to get it distributed to all members, so if it can be formatted in such a way for each, dividing each of the bills and each of the fiscal notes, even if it's a zero fiscal note that accrues to an agency who has made a comment on it, and then a summary at the end. Do you think that would be helpful?
I do.
I think it would be very helpful for the discussion that we're having.
Yes.
And then just deliver that into a mailbox of... I think all 40 members would be most helpful, just so that we understand from a fiscal note point of view how much we're committing in dollars to to the governor's program. Right, Madam Rules Chair? Good.
You're
plan?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so I don't believe, do we have anybody here in the room that wishes to offer any testimony today, any public testimony? Okay, so I think the first thing that we will do is we will conclude public testimony. And Sue, you're okay, and then I may have you take us through the new CS first. I think then we'll proceed to public testimony. And then we're waiting for the amendments to come in, and so it may require us to take a brief at ease while the final amendments are prepared for us. We do have some amendments I'm aware of, but a couple that are yet to be drafted. Is there?
I have one that will be drafted.
Okay.
And then we'll look the next trip.
Okay. And so 1 through 9 right here are just descriptive, and we want to...
That's descriptive.
Okay. So we believe that we have 9 amendments that we're going to take up with the new CS. And so that's our program. I think we'll have Sue take us through the new CS. We will then take public testimony, close public testimony, And then if necessary, we'll take an at ease while we're waiting for the amendments to come to us. So Sue, do you want to take us through this CS, please?
Yes. I'm Sue McLean. I'm from the Department of Law. And the new CS, version R, attempts to address some of those questions that have come up so far in the testimony and presentation of this bill.
And if it's in people's mailbox, then it's not as if it's a caucus. It'll be a lot.
The first change, Mr. Chairman, in the, that we would see in the new CS is on page 2. Formerly, page 2, line 10 of the former bill. And what has changed there is we, the should have been, line 10 in the CS removes the word judicial officer so that the person who has failed to appear has a defense if the person contacted the court as opposed to a judge. That addresses a concern that the court system had that parties should not be addressing the judge personal or contacting the judge outside of court. So it's just it requires the person to contact the court. My understanding is that there may be some suggestion that the person or the attorney could contact the court, and we would agree that that would be reasonable, person or the person's attorney. The next change in the CS is in the same section, formerly page 2, in the former bill, page 2, line 12. There was a concern about person who fails to appear forfeits any security. There is just a stylistic change there. The next change is in the same section about the forfeiture of or of security, and it's in the CS, it's line 21 and 22, page 2, line 21 and 22. We removed that bail is forfeited if a person fails to appear for a violation. That's dealt with in the, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, in the citations, bill related to citations. So we removed that. Next change in the CS. The CS is this the same as the original bill, except for the places I'm noting the changes is on page 4 of the CS, which was page 4, line 14. It's page 4 of this bill. It's page 4, line 14 and 15. Formerly page 4, lines 14 through 16. There was a concern by the court about the need to prepare a report. We simply removed that section. Line 15 adds who is responsible to notify the surety, and that would be the defendant. The next change is on page 4, line 24 and 25. Judicial officer, the section has to do with a judicial officer soliciting comments from the victim of the offense. We, at line 24, modified that paragraph to include that the judicial officer shall consider the victim's comments and any response by the person who's charged. And that's it. The next change is on page 5 of the CS, formerly page 5, line 6 of the original bill. And the change there is simply that there was some redundant language, basically. Specifically, Section H formerly read that information offered or induced at a bail review hearing before a judicial officer, we took out the words "before judicial officer" because only judicial officers are conducting hearings in court and admissibility in a court of law. We just took out that language that to say that it's admissible, period, because court of law was redundant. The next change on page 5, line 4, again, we added, this was a request by the court, page 5, line 10 of the CS, adds that it is the person's lawyer who's required to notify the court and the prosecuting attorney if the person moves or changes their residence. And again, that was sought, a request that was from the court system about who is responsible to notify about a change of address. It's the person's lawyer. The next change is on page 6 of the CS, and it changes what was page 6, line 7 of the old bill. This is page 6, line 11 of the CS. Changes the former law, which provided that a person keep in regular, that a court might require a person, not must, may, require a person to keep in contact with the Alaska State Troopers, to broaden that, to keep in contact with a law enforcement agency, a law enforcement office or agency, simply because in some places it is the municipality that's investigated the crime or a VPSO.
We've been joined by Representative Holmes.
The next change that the CS reflects is on page 7 of the CS. Line 9, and this was formerly page 7, line 14. Line 9, in making a finding regarding the release of a person, we removed the words "or detention." So he's making a finding regarding release of the person. The next change is on line 13-14 of the CS, that was line 19 of the original bill. There was objection to the burden, the language about the burden of proof being a preponderance of the evidence. We simply removed the language. Preponderance of the evidence, so that it now reads, there's a rebuttable presumption that no condition or combination of conditions will reasonably assure the appearance of the person. As a matter of law, rebuttable presumptions are rebutted by a preponderance, but there was concern about that. I will add here that I know there is some concern generally about that language, and if we get to it, we have a some different language, if an amendment is proposed, that might satisfy the concern about those words. The next change in the CS is on page 9 of the CS, line 29, which was formerly on page 10, line 8. Line 29 at page 9 changes the requirement that court may order a person charged with a domestic violence to not contact the victim by telephone or electronic mail. We changed that word to electronic communication so that there wouldn't be any litigation over whether using your Twitter or your text would meet the definition of mail, any electronic communication. Page 10 of the CS, line 29, is addressed a concern of the court system, or the court system regarding the third-party custodian the meaning of appearing before a court could include appearing by telephone, which is as it is now, so that there isn't any, the law now requires the third-party custodian, the court to address the third-party custodian personally, and sometimes that is done by phone, and it wouldn't be our intention that it couldn't be done by phone. And so we just made that clear, and that was at the request of the court system.
Thank you, Sue. Sue, we've been joined by Representative Gatto. Representative Gatto, isn't that girl, Carrie Weiland, just an amazing young prototype of what every American girl should be like?
Well, a lot of people congratulating her. Her testimony is flawless.
She's so poised.
Just keep pushing until you get there.
Yeah, extraordinary life story. It was just a great Alaskan, great American. Representative Gatto and Holmes, we have adopted the R version of House Bill 324, the new CS. Sue McLean is taking us through it. At that point, we're going to take the balance of public testimony. Peggy Brown is here, the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We then will take a break, take an at ease until we have all nine of the amendments delivered to us by Ledge Legal, and those are coming shortly. And then our intent is to move this piece of legislation from committee today. And so, Sue, if you want to continue, we appreciate your help.
The next change in the CS is at page 11. Line 10. The original bill provided that a person couldn't be a third-party custodian if they had a conviction for a misdemeanor within 5 years or a felony within 10. There was concern about that affecting people that had the kind of crimes that wouldn't necessarily DUI or trespassing or something. We just removed the entire section. My understanding is that there is some suggestion that it should be people who have crimes against persons should not be third-party custodians, and we wouldn't be opposed to an amendment like that. But we removed the whole section.
Thank you. I think we're going to hear some public testimony on that, and we have an amendment we're going to offer that's going to find the middle path on that. Is that a good way to put it, Jane? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, we just made a language change in that same section at line 8. It formerly provided that a judicial officer might not appoint a person as a third-party custodian if one or more of the following conditions exist. We just removed the words one or more and left it as a list. The next change is still at page 11. Lines 17 and 18, the former proposal proposed that a person couldn't serve as a third-party custodian if they resided out of state. We added that they could serve as a third-party custodian if the non-resident is residing in the state while serving as a custodian. The next change is at page 13. Line 26, there was concern that a person couldn't be released if they had been convicted of a Class B or C felony and within the previous 10 years had a felony conviction. There was concern about that applying to C felonies, so we removed C felonies. So it would just apply to people who have a B felony or above. The next change is on page 16. It's the last change. Line 24. Representative Gatto correctly pointed out that for all these years that sentence has been grammatically incorrect. So we have changed.
Boy, I am honored.
Changed it to necessary delay meaning a period not to exceed 48 hours. And that's not the last one. Page 18. Line 16. And this refers to the notification of, the surety. The previous bill provided that the court couldn't change a bond unless the surety agreed to the change. We've added the language at the request of the court that that the surety has been notified and agrees to the change. So that it makes it clear that the surety, having been notified, might agree to the change. Just to make it clear that the surety has to know what's going on.
Sue?
Yes, I think that's it.
Representative Perrin has a question for you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue, is there any chance that a surety would tend to disagree with the change?
I don't think so. I think that the reason for this change in the bill was following complaints from sureties who had found that people charged with additional crimes were, they hadn't been notified that the bond that they had provided now covered additional crimes or additional conditions, and they would want to be notified. I don't think in every case that the surety is going to have objection, but the idea is that they should have an opportunity to object, and that the bond they wrote shouldn't be changed without their permission, basically.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. And those are the ways in which the CS changes the original bill that we proposed. I don't know if you have any questions before the public testimony, but I'm available if you do, and I'll be available after the public testimony also.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 6, line 19. 19, sir. How do you force someone to take new or additional meds?
Well, start with all of these bail conditions are things that the court may order as a condition of release. None of them are required. It's just things that the court is permitted to do if requested. And the court may order the person to take medication that's been prescribed by the person. So it's limited to medication that's already been prescribed. So your question was, how do you force them to take new meds? This does not envision new meds. This envisions that they already had a prescription. I don't think you can force someone to go to a doctor and get a prescription. Basically, going up to line 17, both 15 and 16 presume that the person's already under the care of a healthcare provider. I'm not sure that I understood your question completely, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to page 18, lines 15, 16, 17. Representative Herron made a comment on this just a minute ago. If the surety is notified but does not agree, he can therefore bind the court against making any changes. Is that the intent?
Through the chair. When a person gets a bail bond, the The bonds person is guaranteeing, based on certain expectations of the person. So can the bail bondsman bind the court from making any changes without the bonds person's permission? Yes. I mean, I wouldn't frame it that way. What the court can do is say, your bondsman won't agree to continuing the bond at that amount if I change this condition. Therefore, you need to work with your bondsman about whether he's going to require an additional deposit or whether he's going to continue to bond you if this is a new condition. And this goes back to the problem we've been having with people are out on bond, they commit a new crime, and the bondsman, and they go to court and they're arraigned, and the court says, your bond continues as previously posted, and the bondsman wasn't guaranteeing against two crimes. Mm-hmm. That's been the issue, or, you know, a violation of conditions or something like that.
And Mr. Chair, I looked briefly at may not change or add, and I wondered if there was a redundancy in adding or add, but I actually am satisfied that I think it's valuable to leave it there.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, sir. Sue and Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to save this. I don't know if it's a question, but I'd like to save this for Peggy Brown as well.
Okay.
Page 9.
Peggy, please take note.
I guess it's not a question, but I'd like to get on the record from Sue and Peggy lines 24 through 27. And just an explanation so it's on the record of what that means. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Sue, can you help us with that?
Through the chair, we're referring to the prosecution of a crime of stalking that's not a crime involving domestic violence.
And then, Mr. Chairman, parenthetical number one. If you could, I can't figure out a question, but I'd like it on the record what that means. Those two, one, two, three, four lines.
If a person is it just allows a judicial officer, if a person is before the court, charged with stalking. And the victim of the stalking has been in civil court obtaining a protective order against being stalked. What this says is that the judge in the criminal court can say to the person, you have to abide by the conditions that the civil court set on the protective order that the victim previously retained against you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herr.
Again, to get on the record, is there a need to strengthen this or just leave it as presently written? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so Peggy, I think we'll look to you to see how you feel about that, and then if necessary, we can have a kind of a discussion, a mini roundtable discussion with Sue McClain to make sure that we are satisfied with how we're addressing this. I had an interesting, just as an aside, Representative Gatto, some of us had dinner with Carrie Weiland the other night and invited were Judge Carpinetti and Annie Carpinetti, and so it was fascinating to talk to the Chief Justice, and I asked him about this bail bill. It hadn't been updated since 1966, and he was unfamiliar with it, having said that he hadn't practiced on the bench, in the Supreme Court for 12 years. And I, reminded him what we were told by the Attorney General and by you, Sue, which is that these bail provisions hadn't been updated since 1966. And what did he feel were the prevailing issues at the time? And it was fascinating that the two issues that he brought up were that bail bills deal primarily with whether they prevent somebody from fleeing, and bail provisions as they relate to people reentering communities. So it was fascinating for somebody who's far away from the issue to immediately and instantly recognize those really as the two primary issues that are behind updating the provisions in this bill, and in that regard, I think they're correct. So it was a fascinating kind of data point to grab out of thin air, and so it's a very satisfactory test. So this particular provision, as it relates to protective orders, I think is very germane to the conversation today. And Peggy, we will look to you as an expert in this field also to provide your commentary. We look forward to it. Go ahead, Sue.
I had responded, I think, to Representative Heron's question, but if I hadn't done so adequately, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Gatto?
We had talked last time about Section 7, which is now on page 12.
Sorry.
I think that's where we found it, but it had to do with protective order for disallowing the person from going to a person's home, and we talked about or place of work. And
that's on line 4.
Line 4. Yeah, return to the residence of the victim or the residence of a petitioner was protective order.
Through the chair, I apologize, Representative Gatto. I did not incorporate that into our suggestions, and it was completely an oversight because it was a very reasonable suggestion.
No problem. So maybe something we can do conceptually. Okay. Other questions for Sue? Sue, I don't see any. You're doing a splendid job. Thank you for taking us through this. If you'll just stand by. And I know Quinlan Steinler is here. Quinlan, do you want to offer any testimony, or are you just available for questions?
I'm available for questions.
Okay, very, very good. So let's bring Peggy up and have you kind of go through this CS, and we'll see if that leads to any questions amongst the folks that we have here or available by phone. Is that the amendment package? Great. So we're in excellent shape, and we're doing good by way of the clock also. Peggy, we're delighted to have you.
They do not match your list.
No problem. I'm the only one with this list?
Yeah. Okay.
That's the way I like it. Control information. If you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, we're not in any particular hurry, Peggy, so take your time and take us through any concerns that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Brown. I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 324. When we look at this bill, we looked at three things. One was how the bill holds offenders accountable, how it provides safety to victims and communities, and how it might help to advance the governor's initiative. I would like to note for the record that there are two key provisions that we would like to see amended to provide even further protection to victims. We think it's important that to ensure persons with histories of violence against persons are not allowed to be third-party custodians. This would include felony convictions against persons such as rape, murder, and other violent crimes, but also misdemeanor crimes involving domestic violence. And we wanted to stress here we're talking violent crimes, not necessarily nonviolent ones. Unfortunately, we all too often have family members who themselves have quite a history of perpetrating violence, and we don't think they should necessarily be chosen to be third-party custodians. So we believe that that provision would provide stronger protection for victims. Our other recommendation is in reference to Section 19 of the bill that's related to court orders and process. We've heard from several legal advocates in the field that judges feel they are compelled to serve the denial of an application for a protective order because they feel that it's not currently in statute. And so what happens is we have a case, and there's been a few others now, where the respondent or the defendant, perpetrator, didn't necessarily know that a protective order was being placed against him, but he did know when he was served that the application to even get a protective order was denied. So this would just provide a small change to clarify the courts and order process, and it would provide greater safety for victims, and we would strongly encourage the committee to consider that amendment. And finally, Mr. Chairman and committee, I would like to note for the record that we have communicated our concerns to the Department of Law, and we are in agreement that these very small changes would provide large protection for victims across the state. And through the chair, Representative Herron, I would actually like a little bit of time to look at the provisions that you questioned on page 9, lines 24 through 26. What I have noted in this bill is that when you read one section of it, it may refer, have an internal reference to many other sections. So I will get back to you on an interpretation of that from an advocacy perspective.
Madam Chair, no follow-up. I appreciate that, and at least it's on the record for this committee. Madam Chair, if I could ask Peg one other question. And this came up in an earlier hearing, and Peg, I don't know if you were here or someone else was here, but that's page 12, section 7, but page 12, lines 3 on down. But the part that I have a problem with, and I mentioned this before, and Representative Gatto brought it up, is, okay, you can't go to the residence. But that means that that could mean that the person that has an order against them could go back to a village, or for Anchorage, could go into a neighborhood, and they could be close by. And we talked about this, and of course Representative Gatto brought up about the workplace, but is just preventing that person from going to the residence enough in this rewrite?
Well, through the chair, Representative Herron, I think what we end up kind of butting up against here is, you know, judicial discretion. And I know that, say, in Anchorage or larger urban areas, you know, it is not uncommon for protective orders to say you cannot go within 1,000 feet, 100 yards, you know, no matter where you're at, whether you're at work, whether you're in the village, whether you're in next town, there's this kind of zone around the victim. But I do see that gets very problematic in smaller areas, and that judges and magistrates are a little less inclined to do that, because basically they're kind of, you know, asking the perpetrator to leave town, stay out of town, and that's not always amenable for that community. So in short, or I guess a long way of answering your question, is I think that probably speaks more to judicial discretion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could follow up, and I appreciate it, and I'm glad it's on the record, is that, for example, whether it's a village or whether it's a neighborhood, what I'm concerned about is how the person that has the order against goes back, doesn't go back to the residence, stays X number of feet away from the victim, but puts undue pressure on the victim's sister, brother, aunt, uncle. Mr. Chairman, I'd like that for Peggy Brown to put on the record that sort of reality so that it's in the minutes of this deliberation. Thank you.
Can you do that for us, Peggy?
I'm sorry, Representative Herron. What is it you specifically want me to do?
Well, actually, I want you. If, I don't. what I'm having a problem trying to at least get on the record that, you know, you can keep this person physically away from the victim, say 50 feet, 100 feet, 1,000 feet. But that doesn't mean that the person with the order against can't terrorize, or as in our conversations, when a person has control or tries to exert control over people, that they can terrorize the victim's sister, brother, aunt, uncle. And I don't know if we can do it in statutes, but I just, for the record, I want you to share with us the reality of that terror, I guess.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Herron, it's quite common, actually, in crimes involving domestic violence and sexual assault, but particularly with domestic violence, is that you do have exactly what you have said. You have other people in the community that are threatening or coercing. In smaller communities, you have known families, powerful families, families of position, and families of lesser. You have family members of various groups within small communities. And those people, by nature of their association with, let's say, the victim or the perpetrator, ally with whichever one, and of course can make things very difficult for the victim. That is actually one reason why we're kind of hedging that a little bit with the third party custodian and making the recommendation that the person not have a violent crime in their past. And so a perpetrator's brother or mother or whoever isn't necessarily going to be a third party custodian. So I completely agree with you, and I hope that puts on the record your concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cotto.
Thank you. Same place, same subject. In Anchorage, I know it's a special case, but it shows you the way that people can manipulate other people. How about if the victim's on a bus and the other guy sees her boards a bus, boards the same bus? Can't. So since we don't have a limit of 1,000 yards, 100 yards, 5 feet, goes over and sits next to her. It's pretty intimidating. Is that something that we can create language for that just discusses the closeness or the, and in your mind, is it something that we have had seen before and probably ought to deal with?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, yeah, we deal with that all the time. I think that's what judges and magistrates try to do when they set these kind of zones of safety or zones of, you know, no contact. We had a very high-profile case a couple years ago here where we had two very well-known attorneys in the state who ended up at a bar convention together, and, you know, one of them had a protective order against the other one, and it created quite a big hoo-ha. Now, that's on a grander level than, you know, a bus in town, but that kind of shows you the scope, I think, or the range of...
Excuse me, Peggy. Susan, I want to get this on the record. Representative Holmes, did you just snort?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, I just did. Mr. Chairman, I was just laughing at the use of the term grand hoo-ha. And, yes, Mr. Chairman, that resulted in a snort.
And for the record, that was me laughing briefly at Representative Holmes' snort.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's a first in the Judiciary Committee for me.
It is. Go ahead, Peggy. You're back on your game. And furthermore, Representative Holmes, if that's the best you've got, you're not going to be in the skits for a long time. You're going to have to, we had that discussion earlier today.
You're yes, going to
go ahead, Peggy.
So, Representative Gatto, through the chair, I think that might have answered your question, but if not, let me know.
Okay.
Thank you. Do you have any more testimony that you'd like to offer on the bill? I think what we would like to do, Peggy, you're so, you know, I get special privileges now since I'm self-appointed special privileges since I'm leaving this chair after a couple more weeks. You have enjoyed, you know, such extraordinary confidence of this committee, and in your tenure, while I've been in House Judiciary, you've shaped a lot of legislation that has moved from this committee to the Finance Committee, to the House floor, and over to the other body. So when you're having quiet moments where you wonder whether you make a difference in the opinion of this chair and this committee, I think you should know that you do. And we appreciate your contribution. So to that end, if you would sit tight, and Sue, if you would come up, and we will take up these amendments. And I will remind members that also available here in the room are Mr. Peoples from Corrections, Mr. Wolliver from the court system, Mr. Steiner is here, and then online are Rachel Levitt, Jeffrey Mittman from the ACLU, and Lieutenant Dial from the Department of Public Safety. And we do have Sue Stancliffe in the room also, here is the liaison for the public safety. So with that, if there aren't any more questions, is there any more public testimony here in the room or anybody online? All right, seeing none, then I'm going to close public testimony. And we want to get as tight a piece of legislation as we can that's forwarded to the Finance Committee so that they can address the fiscal note and leave, in general, the wordsmithing to this committee. So if you ladies, other than having the opportunity to work on this on the Senate side, and we will, at the appropriate time, be encouraging our colleagues on the Senate side to take up this bill with the governor's bill with appropriate zeal, I would like for us to go through these amendments and kind of try and put a last touch on this as it works its way through the process. So the first amendment I have is from Representative Holmes, and it's R.1. If members would label this, please, Amendment Number 1. Representative Holmes, would you like to move the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 1.
Thank you. Is there an objection?
Object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, just for the record here, these all these amendments were kind of delivered to me while we were sitting here, so if I stumble a little in trying to get through them, one of them, at least I'm not entirely sure, actually does even what I'd intended. So okay. My apologies in advance for my what will probably be an inartful presentation. My intention on this amendment, Mr. Chairman, it's starting on page 2, line 4, dealing with the subsection 3. My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that what this section does is that it's the crime of a failure to appear, which what I'm attempting to do here is change the mental state requirement. Right now, the way the bill is written, in order for somebody to be convicted of failure to appear, they have to know that they were supposed to appear in front of the court at a given time and place. But then if they fail to appear, they don't necessarily have to have a mental state for that, meaning I know I'm supposed to be in court at Monday at 10 a.m. I don't show up. This amendment would be, not only do I have to know that I'm supposed to be in court Monday at 10 a.m., I have to know that I'm not showing up for that appointment, as opposed to, I know I'm supposed to be in court under the current drafting, I know I have to be in court at 10 a.m. on Monday, I don't show up, but I had absolutely no idea, for some reason I had the day wrong, or I had something like that. And so this would require that you not only know when your court date is, but that you actually know that you're missing the court date. It's not an inadvertent.
Okay.
Did that make any sense at all?
It did. comments from Sue or from Peggy, please.
Sue McLean, I do have a comment, and that's I think I in some ways am repeating what I said about why we wanted the failure to appear, but it is precisely that interpretation that is a problem. It does have a knowing mental state. You have to know that you had to go to court that day. And the state has to prove that the person knew they had to go to court that day. And we proved that by showing that they were present in court and were given a court date, and they acknowledged that they knew they had it. But if you add a knowing mental state beyond that, that they had to know it was Monday or they had to not just forget, then the state's in the position of having to prove that we have to disprove the reasons why they didn't appear without knowing what those reasons are. And that's an impossible burden. We can't do that. We can't disprove why you weren't here without knowing why you weren't here. And so, you know, we wouldn't have this problem if we had a state where we have reciprocal discovery, but we do not. So we are not permitted to ask why you weren't here. We can't do that. So, and I will repeat that from the state's point of view, we've always thought that the elements of this crime were that we had to prove that you knew you had to court, and not that you didn't know it was Monday. With that interpretation, basically, just forgetting is always a defense.
Thank you.
And frankly, you have a defense if you forgot and you called the court, because we've built it in as an affirmative defense. If you forgot and you call the court and say, I just forgot and I want to reschedule, you have a defense.
Thank you. And Peggy, if these amendments come up, they're relevant to kind of your domain, you're welcome to offer testimony. And if it's something that's more unique to the court system, then you're welcome to decline comment on this. With amendment number one, do you have any?
No comment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. All right, Representative Hare.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it's elsewhere in the statutes or in this bill, but related to this amendment, how is the person notified?
Sue?
The Chair, Representative Heron, the person is present in court and has signed their conditions of release. And we will have a recording of any presence in court of the person where the court always, the rules of court require that the court always announces a next court date in every court hearing. Okay. If we can't prove that, then they're not guilty of failure to appear because we can't prove an element.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
All right. Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Heron.
No.
Representative Gatto.
No.
Representative Rammers.
No.
One yes.
Five. No. Okay. Amendment number one fails to pass the House. Amendment number two is going to be A.1. This is on page one, line one. Is this just a conforming amendment? Is this just a technical amendment?
Would you like me to walk you through this? This is
amendment. Oh, okay. Yes, okay. That would be helpful. This is an amendment I'm offering as a courtesy for Representative Munoz.
You're not on this committee, right?
Correct. Yes, correct. Good question, Representative Lynn. Jane will help us with this amendment. So I move amendment number two, which is A.1, lock up, Susan.
Oh, for discussion.
Okay, and Representative Holmes objects for the purposes of discussion. Jane?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to the Judiciary Committee. And unfortunately, this amendment was written off the old draft, so it really begins on page 3, line 4. Page 3, line 4, and after 1230.027, it adds, committed a misdemeanor crime against a person under 1141, AS 1141, and it would give the authority to a police officer to make an arrest for somebody on bail who creates a misdemeanor crime against a person under AS 1141, which is a crime against a person.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't tracking exactly what this, I was trying to figure out where we were.
It's okay. Okay. Can you do it again, please?
Sorry. What does this basically do?
page 3, line 4. Mm-hmm. And this would be person prints.
Talking the R version?
This is in the R version.
Okay. I'm having a hard time following it also. So is page 1, line 1 relevant?
That would be a title, in the title.
Oh, in the title. Okay.
So the body of this amendment.
Page 3 on line 4.
Line 4.
One.
And it changes.
So it says where, or 1230027, so we are deleting the word.
Or? Oh, right there. There's an or.
What we're doing is deleting or, and then we're going down, and it should be the same place, page 3, line 4. Following 1230027, we're going to insert a section D, committed a misdemeanor crime against a person under AS 1141. And this would give reason to, for a peace officer to make an arrest. It adds another element of crime.
Okay. And I'm going to, Susan, I'm going to offer this as a conceptual amendment so that it can be made to be more conforming, because it reads, I understand the intent of the amendment, but it reads awkwardly for me as it was drafted. So I have conceptual amendment number 2 before us. Sue, do you have does the Department of Law have an opinion about this amendment?
Through the chair, Mr. Chair, what this amendment would do is allow the peace officer or police officer, excuse me, to arrest for any crime, misdemeanor crime under AS 1141 that is not committed in his presence. The way the law currently stands is as a misdemeanor, a peace officer can't arrest for a misdemeanor that was not committed in his presence except with certain exceptions, such as domestic violence, crimes involving domestic violence. This expands it to all the violent crimes. Our only concern about this, all the violent misdemeanor crimes.
Is what?
Our only, it expands it to all the violent misdemeanor crimes, because a peace officer can always arrest for a felony not committed in his presence if he has probable cause, he or she has probable cause. The only concern we have about this is if a police officer can arrest without a warrant on a misdemeanor and it's a minor crime, the officer may not be taking the time to investigate a case that he would need if he had to seek a warrant. And the person is arrested and brought to court, then the time limit for bringing the person to trial has started, and we're going to have to play catch up if there's more needed to prove the case. But that's our objection to it. As far as the domestic violence crime, the police officer is already allowed to arrest for that more not.
Peggy, any thoughts about this?
I actually agree with Sue on this. I think that, and I didn't bring this amendment.
You get her the microphone just a little bit closer.
I actually agree with Ms. McLean on this in terms of the police officer. In my testimony, I'm really looking at the third-party custodian in terms of crimes against a person. So without looking at this, I haven't seen this amendment, I guess is what I'm saying, and how it fits into this current version R. But what I've heard, I do agree with.
Okay, so would you give me another sense of it? It's a little obtuse for me the way that it's written, so I'm trying to. So a misdemeanor not committed in front of the police officer, what would, can you give me a layperson's example of what that would be, please?
Well, we went through, I'm sorry, I don't come with a list today, but I can probably tick a few of them off. Misdemeanors, a misdemeanor crime of violence, or a misdemeanor crime under 1141,
okay.
That at the present time, a peace officer would have to go get a warrant if peace officer didn't see the crime being committed, would include things like reckless endangerment, that's a misdemeanor, indecent exposure. And frankly, most of the time, these are committed in the officer's presence. The misdemeanor form of stalking, sexual abuse and sexual assault of a minor, sexual abuse of a minor and sexual assault that are misdemeanors, which are usually contact crimes. With the sexual abuse of a minor, it's contact crimes between two kids that are too far apart in age. And I think that's all of them. So at the present time, let's take indecent exposure. The officer would have to go, if the officer did not see it but simply was reported to the officer would have to go obtain an arrest warrant or file a complaint and ask for a summons so that the person was summoned to come to court. That is to give them a citation and say, I didn't see this, so I can't arrest you.
Do you know
the pros and cons of this. But the con is just that there is some concern that that the officer would stop at probable cause, whereas if he had to, he or she had to sit down, write out the probable cause for the warrant, they might realize they had some more investigation they had to do.
Mr. Chairman, do you mind if we have Quinlan Steiner weigh in on this one?
We can, yeah, but I would love to hear from you, Quinlan, very briefly, but I'm inclined to defer to, both of the experts that we have in front of us. So is that your intention to try and?
Well, I was just curious.
Okay, Quinlan, come on up for a second.
I have an intention one way or the other, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Nice to see you, Quinlan. If you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska.
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if we could get Mr. Steiner's impressions of the amendment, thoughts on it.
I just saw this amendment for the first time, and I'm trying to work through this. But it's a fairly radical shift from the way things are done now to eliminate the
radical.
Radical shift. I mean,
okay.
To all move right. From no warrant to.
Okay, point made. Amendment number two is withdrawn. Thank you very much, Quinlan. Amendment number three, we're going to label R.2, amendment number three by Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes, will you move amendment number three, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number three.
I'll object to this.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purpose of discussion. We're on page 5, line 28.
Let me see what we are doing here. All right. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we're all kind of out of order here. Okay, I believe this would delete the sections that explicitly say that a judicial officer may require that a person maintain employment, seek employment, or notify the person's lawyer about any change in employment. The thought being that the purpose of a bail hearing is to sort of basically figure out whether or not the person's going to be a danger to anybody and whether or not the person's going to show back up in court when they're supposed to be there. This doesn't, number six and subsection six and seven that would be deleted here don't necessarily, under the way it's drafted, have to have any relationship to whether or not the person is either a danger to anybody or will show back up in court, to the extent that the requirements that are contained in subsection 6 or 7 about being employed or notifying of employment are relevant to their danger to others or their whether or not they're going to show back up. I believe under subsection 17 on the following page, the court has the ability to order other conditions that are necessary. And so I'm not sure that these are necessary or necessarily relevant to the intentions of bail.
I'm going to maintain this on behalf of Representative Kelly, who on the floor and in caucus continues to bring up the benefit over and over of full employment contributing to healthy communities. I don't know if you ladies have anything, but I hope that the objection is maintained. Any comments? Feel free to be brief.
I will be very brief. At the current bail statutes, which I copied and should be before you just so that it's clear, the first thing that a court has to consider when considering whether a person should be admitted to bail is their ties to the community, and the second or third, I'm sorry, third is whether they're employed.
Thank you.
We think it's reasonable to allow to have a judge say you keep the job you've got.
Mr. Chairman, I think in light of what I'm hearing, unless I'm hearing anything different, I'll go ahead and withdraw.
Okay, amendment number three is withdrawn. I'll pass that on to Representative Kelly. He'll be happy. We have now before us by Representative Holmes amendment number four, which we will label amendment number four R.3. Representative Holmes, would you move amendment
Chairman,
number four?
I will move amendment number four.
Object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects. We are on page 6, line 18.
Mr.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment, and again, I just received these while we were here, so I didn't have a chance to go through. It might have been that I wouldn't have offered them all, given a little more preparation time. But this is the one that, Mr. Chairman, I'm not actually sure actually does what I intended it to do. This addresses the sections that allow the court to order that a person who is under the treatment of a licensed healthcare provider continue to follow the treatment recommendations or continue to be ordered to take medication that's been prescribed. And what this amendment would do would add to those requirements that is true only if the treatment recommendations are necessary to prevent the defendant from being a danger to others. I am actually not sure that was the intent that I had. I was going more towards limiting these to things such as psychotropic meds that might go more to the underlying concern about whether or not the person would show up. I think we had a conversation earlier in the week about whether or not the court should be in the business of ordering somebody to continue to take their insulin shots or other things which would be allowed under the bill as written. I think the more relevant concerns would be more likely medications that would speak more to the person's sort of stability and whether or not they would be likely to either be a danger to somebody else, which I guess is contained in this amendment, or actually show back up. I'm a little on the fence here because I'm not sure the amendment actually does what I intended it to do, but that was where I was trying to go, was to limit this a little bit, not that the doctor could prescribe them to stay on anything.
Representative Lynn?
Through the chair, if you don't take your insulin shots, you might not show up for the hearing. You know, and we want them to show up for the hearing.
Well said. Sue or Peggy, any opinions on amendment number four? I see nothing from Peggy. Sue?
Mr. Chairman, I believe I've explained why we want this, which is that there are a variety of different kind of medications, and it's just a matter of only applies to people who are already on medication, already receiving treatment, to make sure that they're not dangerous and that they will show up.
So does amendment number four help us better define this, or is it superfluous?
Superfluous,
okay. Is the objection maintained?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw this one.
Okay, so number four is withdrawn. Thank you. We're going to proceed to amendment number five, which is R.4. Representative Holmes, will you move amendment number five, please?
Chairman, I move amendment number five.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. We are on page 7, line 9 through 29. Delete all material.
Mr. Chairman, I have, this goes right to the heart of the bill. This is kind of this is the big policy discussion. If I'm on the correct one here, this is the section that creates a rebuttable presumption and sort of shifts the burden from the prosecutors to the defendant, and this one goes. It says that there's a rebuttable presumption that no condition or combination of conditions will reasonably assure the appearance of the person or the safety of the victim, other persons, or the community. And if the person fits into one of five different categories. I think the categories are fairly broad. I think we've had a lot of discussion about the fact that this could lead to much longer bail hearings. This can lead to, it may be, I think there are constitutional concerns since somebody under Alaska law, an Alaska constitutional law has a right to bail. I think this kind of strikes right at that right. I think it's fairly broadly written as well. And in particular, my main, to lay the cards out on the table, Mr. Chairman, I think the main concern I have that I heard some other concern around this table is with subsection B on line 18 that shifts a presumption not just for people who are charged with the serious unclassified felonies or Class A felonies or sexual felonies and all the others, but means anybody who's been charged with a felony, who was previously convicted of a felony within the last five, and you haven't had 5 years elapse from the date of the person's unconditional discharge, that means it could be a felony that somebody was accused of years and years and years ago. They served their time. Maybe they were on probation for a while, I mean, it could be that if you had a felony 10, 15 years ago and you get a second felony, it automatically shifts the burden to you to prove you're not a danger, even if it was something that happened a long time in your past. I think this will be a big financial drain on the court system and the departments. I'm concerned about the whole burden shifting, and that's why the amendment is written broadly. In the absence of support for that, though, Mr. Chairman, I have particular concern with that subsection B.
Representative Herron?
To the amendment, Mr. Chairman, is, I guess I'll follow your lead as far as what you've said on this and the other two pieces of legislation that are attacking domestic violence is, I guess I wouldn't have a problem with the amendment if we kept the standard higher for domestic violence. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Herron.
I object.
Is the objection maintained?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I may. There is, and I did not have a separate, because I didn't have time, I didn't have a separate amendment drafted to do the narrow, but in the absence of support for the overall amendment, I do have interest in the idea of narrowing this to more serious or...
Okay. Just to make it easy for Susan, would you be interested in withdrawing amendment number 5 and then offering conceptual amendment number 6?
I would be... Okay. Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay to go to a vote on number 5 and then offer...
Susan, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Rammers?
No.
1 yes, 5 no.
Okay. Amendment number 5 fails. Representative Holmes, would you like to offer conceptual amendment number 6?
I would like to offer conceptual amendment number 6, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to figure out exactly which subsections.
Why don't we come back to that?
Can we flag it and we'll come back to it? Flag it.
Okay, Susan, we're going to move to amendment number 6 then, which is R.7. Is that okay? Correct. We don't have a conceptual amendment number 6 yet, so we're just going to move to amendment number 6, which is R.7 lockup. By Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes?
Hold on. All right, we got to come back to this.
We'll take our time. Nobody will lose their turn.
R.7, which would be set amendment number 6.
Correct.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
What's number 7?
R.7.
I move amendment number 6.
Representative Holmes moves amendment number 6, which is R.7. That's correct. Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. We're on page 8, lines 11 through 15.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment deals with the issues of the warrantless searches requires certain people who are released on bail to submit to warrantless searches. I think this could be problematic, not only because it expands warrantless searches, but also sort of puts as a condition of bail, as a condition of getting something that you have a constitutional right to, the requirement that you give up another constitutional right.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Rammers?
No.
1 yes, 5 no.
Okay, so amendment number 6 fails. We're now at R.9. I'm going to label this amendment number 7 offered by Rammers. This is R.9. I move amendment number 7.
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. And I'm going to offer an amendment to amendment number 7 on line 3 of the amendment, changing 5 to 3. You got that, Susan?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I now have, is there an objection to the amended version of number seven? Seeing none, the amendment carries. We now have amended number seven before us. My interest in offering this amendment, I believe that we worked with Peggy on reinserting some language that was deleted by the Department of Law. And here simply put, is my thinking. Being familiar with some groups that work in with people that are in recovery, very often what we have are people that are in recovery who, for the benefit of themselves as mentors and the people that they are sponsoring into 12-step programs, often are within that window of a 3-year recovery. They may have their 2-year PIN, for instance, based on a conviction, prior, and I think that 5 years is looking too far back, and that we're missing the opportunity within 12-step programs for people that are in recovery to help other people that are in recovery in the capacity as a third-party custodian. So be interested. That's my thought, and that was my thought for moving it back to 3 years and to relaxing the standard for third-party custodians. So in this case, I'm interested in getting your thoughts both from the Department of Law's perspective and Peggy's perspective also.
This is Sue McLean for the Department of Law. I actually think that this amendment is a good compromise between having a bill that would allow anyone convicted to serve as a custodian to limiting it to most people who've been convicted could serve as custodians, but not if they've been convicted of crimes against people. And I don't object to changing it to 3 years, but I will defer to Peggy on that.
Thank you, and I'm glad that we're pointing out that with embedded in this statute is that somebody with convicted of a violent crime is excluded from being a third-party custodian. Peggy, your thoughts, please, on amended version of number seven?
Peggy Brown, Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I think this is, I also agree, I think this is a good compromise and makes it stronger. And I appreciate your comments and reasoning, because there are a lot of Alaskans in that situation that you mentioned who this would benefit.
And so then my question would be about the 3 years, whether, as a rather arbitrary selection, we understand the methodology behind it. Do you feel that 3 years is the right number? More or less, and as the chair, I'm open to what your professional judgment, what the right number is.
Well, when we were thinking about the number, we said 3 to 5, so I think it's right in there.
Okay, great. All right, so is the objection is removed. Seeing no other objections, amendment number 7 passes from committee. Now, amendment number 8, which is R.8 by Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes, will you move the amendment, please?
Chairman, I move amendment number 8.
Object. Representative Dahlstrom objects. We have R.8 before us on page 14, line 14. Mm-hmm. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This deals, I believe, with the material witness section that we had discussed earlier in the week about how a material witness may not be detained. What it says right now, Mr. Chairman, on page 14, line 12, is that a material witness may not be detained because of inability to comply with any condition of release if the testimony of the witness can adequately be secured by deposition. And this would remove the last part of that sentence, which now reads, unless further detention is necessary to prevent a failure of justice. The rationale behind this being that if you can adequately, and the word adequately is in there, if you can secure their testimony by deposition adequately, then saying that you can continue to detain this person in jail for what I see as fairly broad language, anything that is necessary to prevent a failure of justice, I don't know exactly what that means, Mr. Chairman. It seems pretty broad, and given that you can keep them unless you can adequately get their deposition otherwise, seems to be sort of unnecessary.
Well, this is the chair, and as I spoke of once before Representative Kelly, in this case, I think I'll speak on behalf of former Representative Samuels, who actually sat right in your seat and often defaulted to justice first and cast a broader net. So I find myself against the amendment and in favor of the more aggressive language on behalf of victims. Any comments by from you, Sue, or Peggy?
Please repeat that, Mr. Chair. Where are you going on this?
I am speaking against Amendment Number 8 and on behalf of victims. I think that as the bill reads now, it casts a broader net on behalf of victims and families of victims. So I'm interested in brief remarks from Sue or Peggy and any other thoughts by Representative Holmes.
This is Sue McLean. I would start by saying I think that in many cases, a deposition will resolve the problem of the witness who's failed to appear. However, you can't predict what's going to happen in every case. And it may be, for example, that the witness has given a deposition, but let's say the witness was a prosecution witness, but the defense is objecting to the admission of it, and you know that at the time you're taking the deposition. Those things can happen. So it's just a place to give the court some direction about what to go or where to go if you really, truly haven't adequately secured the testimony you need from the witness. And I have nothing further.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
Yes, call your attention to line 13, mostly near the end of the sentence, the word can. If the testimony of the witness can adequately be secured, does not indicate that it was adequately secured. Consequently, the phrase necessary to prevent a failure of justice, unless further attention, I think is proper.
Are there other questions? Peggy, any thoughts on this?
Yes, as I read this, one of the concerns that we do have two concerns. One, with unless further detention is necessary to prevent a failure of justice, there is, it would seem that a material witness could be detained indefinitely until you could show there wasn't going to be a failure of justice. And two, another concern that we have had, which may be fixed, and I need to really look at this, is in the case of addressing recalcitrant witnesses or witnesses who, you know, don't want to come forward as a material witness because there's, you know, basically they're afraid to do so for whatever reasons, and they choose not to testify. And one concern I might have with this is that it be a mechanism to kind of force a witness to be a part of a mini trial, if you will, in the conditions of release that might endanger her safety.
Okay.
So just to put that on the record as a possibility, although I do understand the intention of this.
Okay, so the policy call here then, is, as I understand it, is the interest in the fact that a deposition may result in the failure of a witness to appear. So the concern of being able to prosecute and the benefit that the would be derived by the victim and the victim's family against a concern that that a reluctant witness may be forced to participate in a proceeding which may undermine their sense of safety and security. Is that kind of the balance that we have to choose? Okay, so in that case, I'm going to continue to be opposed to the amendment, and I'm going to vote on behalf of the lesser concern on the table.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw Amendment Number 8.
Number eight is withdrawn. We now have Amendment Number 9 before us. I will move Amendment Number 9, which is R.10, Luckup. Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. This is page 16, line 14. A peace officer shall use every reasonable means to serve process under this chapter, period. A judge may not order a peace officer to serve a petition that has been denied by the court. And I'm not certain my rationale behind this amendment, but I feel strongly about it. And Sue, if you want to tell me why I feel so strongly, I'd be grateful.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, as
thought a lot about this, and I'm very ambivalent.
This is Sue McLean. As Peggy Brown testified to earlier, apparently what is happening with protective orders is that because they're orders, some judges have felt that if the court orders that the petitioner's petition is not granted, that that has to be served on the respondent. But process, in our, this is, means that it's an order to come to court. You don't have to come to court if there's nothing to respond to. And it pragmatically, it's wasteful of judicial resources and judicial services resources, in addition to the reasons that Peggy Brown testified that it can create more problems than it solves. There's simply no reason to serve a non-complaint on anyone.
Indeed. All right, is the objection maintained?
No, I will withdraw it.
Okay. Is there any other objection? Seeing none, amendment number 9 passes from committee. We now move to amendment number 10, which is R.5 Luckup by Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes, will you move amendment number 10, please?
I move amendment number 10.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. We are on lines, page 16, line 15 through 26, and then it looks like some conforming language. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This goes to the change from 24 hours to provide the requirement that bail be decided 24 hours after arrest, change it to 48. This would delete those sections, thus taking it back to the original 24 hours. My concern, Mr. Chairman, is on a couple of fronts. One is the constitutional issue that in our state you do have a right to bail, and I believe there are several court decisions that have ruled that 24 hours has been considered adequate, and so therefore extending it to 48 may run into some constitutional questions. Second of all, I'm concerned that although in some cases there might be more of an interest in having a little bit more time, by changing this and making 48 hours the default for all arrests and all bail is kind of going a bit overboard, and now with that the standard, keeping people in jail for longer, running up costs, and keeping people that I'm afraid that we could end up with a situation where it's happening in a lot more than just a handful of cases.
Okay, and so in this case, I'd like to ask both Sue and Peggy and Mr. Peoples, I'd like to get a quick answer from you on whether this will put any undue pressure on our intake centers if we have folks that are being held routinely for a longer period of time. Sue, Peggy, and then Mr. Peoples, please. Just very quickly.
This is Sue McLean. I don't know whether or not it will put undue pressure on our intake centers. I would add that we are in a very, very small minority of states that draws the line at 24 hours. We are one of only three in the whole United States that draws that line. Most are 48 hours or 24 hours, but excluding weekends and nights, which gives you a chance to investigate. But I can't speak to what that will do to the intake centers.
Peggy, any thoughts?
My only thoughts here is, and again, I'm coming from the scope of domestic violence and sexual assault, is that 48 hours, it does allow for a more cooling off period if necessary. But weighing that against, resource allocation in various communities, I would have to say that the only advantage I would really see would be that in that extra time period, that extra 24 hours, there is more that can be done to notify the victim, and that actually is significant.
So the cooling off period as it relates to DV issues is a safety and security issue, and Representative Holmes, your concern is that this casts a net over all detentions, and so there is the policy call. And again, this takes us back to the day that we initially introduced this bill, which is a one-size-fits-all for not only rural and urban, but also violent crimes versus nonviolent crimes, and there we are trying to draw the distinction, which is why we all signed up and ran for office. Mr. Peoples, can you give us just a brief comment on any pressure this will put on our intake centers? And Representative Herron has a question.
For the record, Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections. To the chairman, if this if 48 hours became the default, universal default for holding before he went to bail, it would impact, to what degree I cannot tell you, on the unsentenced facilities, which are our most crowded facilities.
Okay, thank you for that. But in the meantime, as this relates to some, not all, is this something that we have the capacity to absorb without putting our men and women in corrections at risk, let alone some of the other folks that are being detained in a, you know, an already at capacity?
To the chair,
facilities.
It would have some impact on the unsentenced facilities, especially the rural areas.
Okay, all right, thank you very much. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess following, again, your lead about this is really initially, or I mean, the intent was to deal with the domestic violence, and I listened carefully to what Peggy said. Is Peggy, I guess, through the chair, Peggy, I think that the intent of the governor's initiative is that domestic violence should have a higher profile when rewriting these laws. And again, listening to you carefully, sometimes the 48 hours works, but wouldn't and sometimes the 24 hours would work for the process to get going quicker rather than later. I guess that's where I can't figure out where I want to go with this because of your comment.
Peggy, and then Representative Lynn has a question.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, it's a good policy call. I think not only are you looking at the difference between 24 hours and 48 hours, there's a couple of things that I can think of. One is more of a cooling off period. Two, notifying the victim. But I also recognize that you have in rural areas a different set of circumstances in some cases. And this might not be the forum, but we see a lot of victims who get arrested for domestic violence because there hasn't been the proper time to investigate. So 48 hours, that extra 24 hours might even allow for better or increased investigation. So it's really a call. I don't envy your position.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I think she did help me out a lot there on that because it goes back again to what you said when we started this process with the Attorney General is should we address domestic violence in these rewrites or should we have one size fits all for all crimes? And I would say that I actually like the intention of the amendment, but I think that maybe domestic violence should get the higher profile and the rest we leave behind for another bill.
Interesting. Representative Lynn?
Am I reading this correctly? On line 25, it says a period not to exceed 48 hours. So could not the judge make it to 24 if they chose? So I'll leave it to the discretion of the judge here, but they could go to 48 hours in that particular incident deserved it.
Representative Lynn, I think this is what we heard from Deputy Commissioner Peoples is that if it was all folks were held for 48 hours, it would put a significant burden on intake centers because we anticipate that it will be some is a different standard, and I think that the concern for the court is to recognize passively that there is a benefit of cooling off for some of those who have been in domestic violence situations where they may be returning to the household and that this 48-hour provision may assist in that as the court functions the way that it is designed, notwithstanding the ability to be able to use weekends and nights to benefit the court system, which is also overtaxed in its resource allocation, that the court system has helped those families have been subject to domestic violence are helped, and that in many cases the process of speedy appearance before a judge is not going to be disturbed. But we'd like to hear from Quinlan Steiner and get your opinion on this, please. Quinlan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think you're correct, Representative Lynn, in your interpretation, in the assessment of the chair, at least.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quinlan Steiner, Public Defender for the State of Alaska. I think the use of the change from 24 to 48, you know, won't apply in every case. You know, the court does try to get it, but it will apply in some cases. But the risk of that is that the 48 for the initial arraignment and then 48 for the first bail hearing adds 4 days to the first opportunity you have to get out of jail, which in smaller cases, you know, run the risk of exceeding the time you might actually spend in jail. That's the concern or the impact.
Thank you. And this goes also back to the fiscal note as it related to corrections, that there may be an increment at intake and then a decrement once we get to time served, which was an issue that we had taken up in a previous session. Are there any questions for Quinlan? Thank you for your testimony on the matter. All right, the objection to...
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Holmes.
You know, as with most of these, you know, these aren't cut and dry. They are hard. So, you know, I'm struggling a lot as I'm offering these amendments. I'm not sure how I'm coming out on a lot of them. It's the debate, as you put it, of casting a broad net and picking up everybody while we're trying to get a narrow scope, and what do we do here? I'm going to go ahead and continue with this amendment because I feel like it's overly broad for what we're trying to do, but in doing so, I understand that there are cases in which it would be helpful, so I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression by the amendments I'm running that these are hard calls, but I'm going to...
Depends on your point of view. For the chair, not so hard.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herring.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I concur with my colleague is that, and listening carefully to Peggy is, and what I just want to reiterate and reinforce my comment, I think that domestic violence in this proposed legislation should be held to a higher standard, and some of the amendment is inappropriate. So I guess... unfortunately, I'm going to have to vote no.
Okay. And Sue, perhaps these are notes that you can take with you as this bill finds its way not only to House Finance but also Senate Finance to offer some division in the statutes that the 24 and 48-hour bail provision are applicable to, if that would fit into the court system and the Department of Law's prosecution of these matters. Okay. So with that, the objection is maintained.
Yes,
sir. Susan, will you take the vote? A roll, please.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
No.
One yes, five no.
All right, so amendment number 10 fails. That takes us to...
R.6,
which is amendment number 11. Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes, will you move the amendment, please?
I move amendment number 11.
So Representative Dahlstrom objects. For the purposes of discussion, we have before us amendment number 11, which is R.6. Luck up.
And Mr. Chairman, this one shouldn't take very long because it's basically the second half of the last amendment. It's changing the 48 hours back to 24 hours in another section of the court rules. So it's basically, in my understanding, a similar debate to the one we just had. Unless Sue has a different take on it, I think that's what I... So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much debate we have to have on this one.
None is necessary. You wish to maintain the amendment?
I'll maintain the amendment.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We received quite a packet from the ACLU, and one of their comments under the 24-hour rule, and don't bother looking, it's what it says, only 7 states explicitly permitted more than 24 hours prior to the initial hearing. But I see that 7 states have done it. That just seems to allow us to imitate 7 states.
Well said. Sue?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I would also add that at the beginning, when we proposed this bill, we provided the committee with a chart of all of the bail statutes in every state, and in fact, many more than 7 have permitted more than 24 hours. Some are very vague. 22 of them are simply as quickly as necessary, but some have much longer than 24 hours. So
Thank you.
It's certainly permissible.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Mr. Chairman, again, following your lead, the intent of this from the administration was to go after domestic violence people. So on this one, I'm going to be a yes vote in the spirit of that, sir.
Thank you. Representative Holmes.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one thing, that one comment, though, on the comment from Sue. We are actually one of the only states, if not the only state to my knowledge. I don't want to overstate the point because I don't have all my facts, but unlike the federal constitution, and I believe in many other states, we do actually have a constitutional right to bail, which is different from other states.
Sue?
If I may, what the Constitution guarantees, and one of the things that's troubled me about this debate, is we're talking about your first appearance before a magistrate. And what the Constitution requires is that a court find probable cause within 48 hours. I don't know, as our Constitution sets any particular time for your right to have your bail decided. I mean, it just says you have a right to have the court consider bail, unlike 18 states that have crimes for which there, I mean, other than capital offenses, for which there's no bail at all. So, I just want to make that clear about what the Constitution actually requires. I do think there are other states that have a right to bail in their constitution.
Representative Holmes.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's why I said I didn't want to overstate my point, because I'm not trying to say that this is determinative on this issue, but the fact that we do actually have a right to bail, the timeliness of that is one factor in it, and that is a consideration. I'm not trying to say how it would be determined.
Thank you. And as we wind up, amendment number 11 and any conceptual amendments offered after that, before we move this bill from committee, Peggy, I will have you speak to the fact that as we're calculating statistics, that you will have you read into the record and remind the committee that we are number 50 when it comes to the way that we are statistically seen by the rest of the United States as it relates to domestic violence, which is what got us to this legislative package in the first place. And we only have one rural member that serves on this committee. And for those of us that have made a choice to live in an urban community, to whatever extent we have the ability to flee, our friends that choose, for whatever reason, to live in a rural community, sometimes their ability to flee an unsafe situation is much less elective. And I've been trying to be mindful of that through all three of the bills that have come before us, but in particular, this piece of legislation, which has made those policy calls that are otherwise perhaps seen only through the lens of an urban community, more difficult to call. But if this is a one-size-fits-all piece of legislation, then it's made it remarkably easy for the chair, at the very least. So with that, the objection to amendment number 11 is maintained.
Yes, sir.
Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Herron.
Excuse me, sir.
Were you doing an autograph of one of your newsletters?
No. The amendment to the amendment, yes, sir. Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Just for clarification.
We're on amendment number 11.
We're on amendment number 11.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's the one.
Okay.
The second.
You voted no on amendment.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Yes. Right.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Grunberg is not present. Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Rammer?
No.
Two yes, four no.
So by vote of 2-4, amendment number 11 fails to pass the committee. Representative Holmes, you have a conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chairman, may we go off the record for just a moment?
Yep, take a brief at ease. It's 2 minutes to three. Representative Holmes has a conceptual amendment number 12 that you wish to offer.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer conceptual amendment number 12 on page 7, that we delete subsection D2B on lines 18 through 21 and renumber the rest accordingly.
We have the
subsection which?
D2B line on lines 18 through 21.
Okay.
So Representative Lynn, Section D stays in place, and so do 1 and 2, and then A, B, C, D, and E, Section B is deleted. So D would stay in place, and 1 and 2 would stay in place, but it would be A, C, D, and E would be the remaining language. Sue, would you tell us your thoughts on Section B? Representative Dahlstrom.
Object to discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion.
To the chair, first of all, I would like to correct what I have heard a couple times as a misconception, which is we nowhere in this bill are we talking about holding people without bail. We're talking about that the court should consider this in setting bail, but that bail should be set. Basically, we're talking about someone who's been less than 5 years off probation for the last felony. With many people, that will also be 5 years from the date of the last felony because, typically they may not have gotten a long sentence. But with those that have gotten a long sentence, we're talking about years and years. We're talking about serious, serious crimes. And we're talking about whether or not that person, 5 years out from, say, their conviction for rape or sexual assault, should be required to say to the court, this is my plan for why you should let me out of jail. Pending trial, right. This time. This is why you should believe I will behave. I don't think it's an overly burdensome. It doesn't say if you were ever convicted of a felony. It says you've only been out of jail 3-4 years, and here you are again. And that's our thinking in this particular part.
Thank you, Sue. Peggy, do you have any thoughts on conceptual amendment number 12?
I just had a question. Would sexual felony listed under A be directly affected by the removal of B at all? In considering sexual felonies from another state?
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, it shouldn't. Subsections A, C, D, and E should all be left in. So if somebody was charged with a sexual felony, the burden would still, this is a burden shifting, Mr. Chairman. When you're deciding whether or not to let somebody out of jail on bail, you can still, the stuff that's contained in subsection B, whether or not somebody was charged with a felony and charged with a felony within the last few years, even if this amendment passes, could still be considered. It's just a question of whether or not the prosecution has to kind of go first or the defense has to go first, I believe.
If I may just be clear, they're charged with a felony this time. It requires that they have been convicted the previous time, not just charged. That really would be too far if they'd been charged. They have to be convicted previously.
Okay. Sorry, I misspoke if that's what I said. That was unintentional.
Okay. Are there other questions for Sue or for Peggy or for any of our other members? Is the objection maintained?
Yes, sir.
So the objection to conceptual amendment number 12 is maintained. Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
No.
2 yes, 4 no.
So by a margin of 2-4, conceptual amendment number 12 fails. Do any of the members have other amendments that they wish to offer to House Bill 324? Seeing none, I'll bring the bill back to the committee. And if I could just have, for the record, Peggy, if you could briefly give us a summary of what House Bill 324 does in the context of what brought us together here in mid-January. Please.
Sure. In summary.
Just introduce yourself again for the record.
Peggy Brown, Executive Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. In summary, we believe House Bill 324 does increase offender accountability and does provide more safety protections for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Some of those changes small, some of those protections large. And I believe this bill also advances the governor's initiative. And I appreciate all the work that this committee has done on this bill, and I hope that we have a good bail reform bill.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Yes, Sue, just for clarification, when we talked earlier in the meeting about adding or place of work in Section 7, you commented that you had overlooked it. Does that mean we had passed it last time and it can be added, or do we need an amendment right now?
Sue?
Well, it's not in the bill that we're passing out, so.
We better just make an amendment.
Thank you. So Representative Gatto, I'll have you make, offer conceptual amendment number 13, please.
That's my district, sir.
Lucky.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll offer conceptual amendment number 13, page 12, line 4, following residence, add or place of work.
Without objection, conceptual amendment number 13 passes. We now have House Bill 324 before us. The Chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 324-26-GH2910R with attached amendments, both conceptual and written, attached physical note, and individual recommendations from committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object, and if I may speak to that for a second.
Representative Holmes objects for purpose of discussion or the purpose of a vote?
I think for the purpose of a vote, Mr. Chairman. I think there's some very good things in this bill, and I think there are some very good policy discussions in this bill. I'm having trouble moving the bill out of committee in its present form. I don't want that to be misinterpreted as I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think my record on combating domestic violence and sexual assault in this building is fairly strong, and I feel very strongly about that. And I think there's some very good stuff in here, and I think there was some very good work done on the CS. I think that's been very collaborative. I was very happy to see that. But at this point, I'm not comfortable with the bill in its present form, and so I'm going to object to moving it from committee at this time.
Noted. Susan, will you take a roll, please?
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
Yes.
5 yes, 1 no.
So by a vote of 5 yes, 1 no, the House Judiciary Committee has passed the third of 3 comprehensive crime bills, all targeted at trying to reduce the sexual assault and domestic violence that have made Alaska statistically a real disappointment across the country, and we hope collaborative with other efforts by law enforcement teaching better values in our homes and schools and our communities and our churches and synagogues and on television and with public service announcements that we will begin a 10-year trend and step toward creating safer homes, families, communities, villages, towns, and cities. And with that, at 10 minutes past 3, unless there are any other remarks from committee members, seeing none, we're adjourned.